Hi, I'm Richard Alsaberg. This is number 0105, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, once again, it's time for another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0105. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actress Julie Newmar, best known as the original Catwoman from TV's Batman. What's it like to constantly hear from men of all ages that she was their first turn-on?
But they're always polite, you know, and I think it's quite an admission. But you can see more or less what they're thinking in their eyes. And it's a huge compliment. I've never, ever received this statement as anything less than a compliment. A high compliment indeed.
Actor Sean Kanan, who's best known for his role as Deacon Sharp on The Young and the Restless. But he's also a great cook. He has a book out called The Modern Gentleman, Cooking and Entertaining with Sean Kanan.
I'm self-taught, which is one of the great things that I love about this book, because it means that if I can learn to do it, you can learn to do it. You know, I lived in Italy for a while, and I picked up a few things there, and, you know, for me, it's kind of therapeutic. I love cooking.
Robert Major is a former federal undercover agent and the author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. It takes a special breed of person to be an undercover agent.
You go through an undercover school where that school is generally run by some of the best undercover agents that have worked previously. One of my mentors who was part of the training is Joe Pistone, who the book and the movie Donnie Brasco is based on. And they're also psychologists who participate in the vetting process, looking for characteristics in individuals that they feel are going to be able to help them better deal with the stress, the physical and mental stress that they're going to be encountering by living a double life for years at an end.
And, of course, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0105, is Richard Alsabad, who is one of the three technical engineering geniuses that works at Global News Montreal, who keep us on the air. Thank you very much, Richard, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, Professor Brian Ford, a fellow at Cardiff University in England, just came out with a new book called Secret Weapons, Technology, Science, and the Race to Win World War II. As the title suggests, Ford's research has turned up some very interesting and previously unknown plots to bring down Hitler and the Nazis. Perhaps the most amazing was Britain's bizarre plot to turn Hitler into a woman. Quite literally. Apparently, the Allies hoped to smuggle the female sex hormone estrogen into the Führer's food so that he would become more feminine and less aggressive. Okay, wouldn't it be just easier to poison the guy and kill him outright and end it there? Anyway, Ford says there were agents who would be able to get it into his food. It would have been entirely possible. Another funny one included dropping glue on Nazi troops in an attempt to literally stick them to the ground. Okay, sorry, but I'm pretty sure they lifted that last one from the Coyote's Playbook, from those classic Roadrunner cartoons. I mean, were the Allies working from the Acme catalog or what? Wow. Anyway, moving right along. Usually, when a woman gets a big rock, she's the envy of all of her friends. But not so in the case of Isabelle Prévost of Saint-Théodore-d'Acton here in Quebec, Canada. The mayor of the small town, which is just east of Montreal, is Danny Lariviere. He also happens to be Isabelle's ex-husband. So for her birthday, he dropped off a 20-ton boulder in her driveway with the words, "Happy Birthday, Isa XX," spray-painted on it and topped off with a big pink bow. Quebec police are still deciding whether criminal charges are appropriate as the mayor apparently refuses to remove the boulder. Isabelle called police to file a complaint after discovering the delivery. Her parents described the incident as disgusting, and her mother told the Canadian press that their daughter was too upset to give an interview. So that's why she's not here with us on the Stuff File program. Yes, disturbing is probably a good way to describe this story. Yet once again, there has to be a certain amount of style points involved here, don't you think? Really? A little bit of creativity? A little. Okay, moving right along. A 25-year-old woman in New Zealand thought that she was getting revenge on her cheating husband by smashing her car into his mistress's apartment. Only one small problem. Wrong apartment. The woman, whose name has been withheld, pleaded guilty to causing about $43,000 worth of damage to the property in the town of Nelson. Apparently, the hot flames of jealousy were fanned when she read a text message sent to her husband from another woman. So, unbeknownst to the husband, who, by the way, was riding in the passenger seat of the car at the time, she drove to what she thought was the mistress's address and plowed through the apartment's complex gates and into the garage of an apartment. Unfortunately, that apartment belonged to someone else. Ah, yes, revenge is a dish best served at the correct address. And finally, in this edition of the Stuff File program news, before we get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, time for the Darwin File, because as you know, the Tree of Life is often self-pruning. And we have a couple of items from the Darwin File for you. A 24-year-old man riding a party bus for his friend's bachelor night in Detroit in June was killed on Interstate 95 when he popped open an emergency escape hatch on the bus's roof and peered out at the sights. His head slammed into an overpass. Got the visual? Yeah. And a 59-year-old woman who had borrowed a steamroller, again, this sounds like it came from the Acme catalog, she borrowed a steamroller to help with maintenance on a road near her home in Whatcom County, Washington, in June, lost control of the vehicle, sending it into a ditch where she was thrown and fatally rolled upon. Another Wile E. Coyote moment for you. That's all I have to say. And that's the Darwin File, boys and girls. Let's get to our first guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Julie Newmar, quite simply, is an acting icon. The original Catwoman from the Batman television series, and also, if you go back a little further, Rhoda from My Living Doll. She is a Tony and Golden Globe winning actress who has a new book out called The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth, and she joins us on the line from California. Hi, Julie.
Hello, and I'm so pleased to be here somewhere.
We're so pleased to have you. We're so pleased to have you. You've written this book, The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth, and why write this book now?
Well, it's not a tell-all. It's not a Hollywood embarrassing kind of thing. It's really because people want to know what it's like being inside someone who lives the kind of life that I live. I mean, not just how you look, but why things turn out the way they do. It's a how-to book. That's what it is.
When you look back at your life and career, are you surprised by the things you've managed to do in the time that you've been acting?
I think the answer is a sweet yes. I am surprised because of the many lives. Sometimes they say the nine lives, or I say the nine plus lives now, since Batman, which was, now it's 45th anniversary.
You had a character, a role on Batman, when you play Catwoman, that even in this day and age, grown men turn into little boys talking to you.
I've noticed that. And their fathers and their grandfathers. And sometimes someone will walk up to me on the street and say, "Miss Newmar, did you know that you were my first turn-on?" And then I gather up enough courage to ask them how old they were. And surprisingly, it gets younger. And now it's about the ages of 4 or 5. So there's a kind of connection to what the world will be like in the future, that it's okay, a little dangerous, but still fun to be in, a good place to play.
Well, what was it like when that first started happening to you, when guys would come up and say, "You're my first turn-on"?
But they're always polite, you know, and I think it's quite an admission. But you can see more or less what they're thinking in their eyes, I've noticed. And it's a huge compliment. I've never, ever received this statement as anything less than a compliment, a high compliment indeed.
I mentioned that you won a Golden Globe. I mentioned that you won a Tony. So obviously your acting career goes well beyond Catwoman, but you're so tied to that role, and you've even put that title in your book. Was it something that you, I mean, the conscious Catwoman, was it something you consciously have decided to keep as part of your persona?
The truth is what the public sees in me or anyone else, and Catwoman being most attributed to me is, you know, it catches the eye. And I even made the word Catwoman the bigger word on the cover. The fact that it says the conscious Catwoman explains life on Earth is just to kind of give it a little more humorous fillip, if you follow me. It's kind of advice and good things to do and things you might cut out and put on your icebox to stay at the right weight. It's my favorite of all books was the how-to books. Those are the books I grew up on, so I just thought I'd write one.
I mentioned the Tony Award, and we should mention you won the Tony Award for, I believe it was The Marriage Go-Round, is that correct?
Yes, right, on Broadway. I was 24. It was my first acting role. I just happened to be in the best of company with Claudette Colbert and Charles Boyer. I have a wonderful director, a brilliantly funny script, and they handed it to me. What can I say?
And you've had other Broadway roles too, and I'm just curious how you feel about the fact that, you know, you've had some big roles on Broadway, but in some cases, other women got to play those roles on film.
I was Stupefying Jones in Little Abner. I played that on film. I played Katrin Stegg. The Marriage Go-Round, I played that on film. Let me see. What did I not play on film?
What about Silk Stockings?
Oh, that was just a starting part. I had a very tiny role in that. And that was finally done, not my part, but the lead part. Let me see.
Sid Charisse?
Who did that? Sid Charisse did it, yes. She played this wonderful Russian spy. The great Garbo did it in the first version, film version of that. But then it became a musical, which was written by Cole Porter.
Mm-hmm. What do you prefer? Do you prefer film, television, or the Broadway stage?
Actors almost unanimously will say they prefer the stage because there's so much give back from the audience. And it's like, were you with real people? So you have a real sense of life there. And it's lovely to hear people laugh at something. It's the audience is the reward.
Being an icon, there are not too many people who get their name in the title, not above the title, but in the title of a movie. Tu Wong Fu, Julie Newmar.
That was quite fun, and it's become popular down through the years. It's about 15 years old. Greta Garbo had her name in a title. I think there have been one or two others, come to think of it.
John Malkovich was another.
Yes, right. Well, they made fun of me, but lovingly so. And it was just, they emulated the style, or maybe it was my height. I don't know. It was great fun, and that's what entertainment is mainly about.
In the Hollywood of your youth, how do you see it different from what passes for Hollywood today?
People have asked me that many times, and why Batman has taken on such a dark, dark trend. But come to think of it, the show that I did came before the Vietnam era, And that changed America a lot. We got lost in a lot of the folly of these wars that we've been perpetrating in the last couple of decades. And it's turned our entertainment and some of our social behavior in a downward trend. And it's quite noticeable. And people do seem to prefer the happier days, or the days when the rest of the world looked upon us favorably, at least up until the end of the 60s. Hmm. So that's my take on it. And, of course, there's a lot more pyrotechnics, the whole, all the explosions and the ear-deafening noises that happen there. For many of us, kids like it, but I think it kind of wastes our energy. I prefer a very good storyline. I prefer good writing. Mm-hmm.
One of the things you talk about in your book, The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth, and you have a lot of pearls of wisdom to share, but you say women bloom later in life.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you just get started in your 20s. You just begin to learn. And what is it? We're all in the one century now. We're living almost three times as long. So we've got to take care of ourselves and let the rest of the world love us this way. It's important that we do the right thing, I think. You know, think the better thought. Spend our time with joy rather than criticism and not a good level of self-love.
Well, there,
that's important.
There are many fans out there, and mostly men, who would probably think that you came along full-bloomed many, many years ago and have stayed that way all this time. The book is The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth. It's written by Julie Newmar, and people can take a look at Julie's website as well, which is julienewmar.com. I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's been a delight. Thank you.
Actress Julie Newmar, best known for her iconic role as the original Catwoman on TV's Batman, and the author of The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth. You can visit her website at julienewmar.com, and you can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0105, and you'll find links to her site and also links to amazon.com, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of four out of five dentists.
The fifth dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Sean Kanan from The Young and the Restless, who has a new book out called The Modern Gentleman. And we'll also meet a former undercover federal agent and the author of the book, The Infiltrator. Of course, there's also an Idiot of the Day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news, including right here, right now. In Delavan, Wisconsin, a 33-year-old married woman had herself a nice little affair with a 35-year-old married man from Egerton. He gave her herpes, and apparently her shame isn't enough to keep her from suing the guy for $350,000. Neither of the parties' names have been released, but the woman contends in her lawsuit that the man was legally liable for knowingly exposing an uninfected and unknowing partner to the sexually transmitted disease. Oh, and guess where they met? On Facebook. She says the man and I had mutual contact through Facebook, phone, instant messaging, email, and in person from the summer of 2009 to June 2011. This contact included sharing confidences, flirting, touching, asking, and eventually receiving provocative pictures of myself and multiple meetings. The two ended up setting up a rendezvous, a secret rendezvous, in Madison, Wisconsin, this past January, where they hooked up. In May, she asked police to arrest him. The man has denied giving the woman herpes and told her to check with her other partners. She says her only partners for the last 8 years had been her husband and him. She also says she now experiences panic attacks while driving with her spouse and children, and her husband won't have sex with her because of her diagnosis. She's lucky to still have a husband because of her diagnosis. And the fact that he's in a car with her at all? I don't know. I did say both of them were married, right? So the other spouses better get checked. Okay. You know, this show, the Stuff File program, is heard on China Airlines for their long-haul Dynasty flights. And we appreciate China Airlines for their support and for playing the programs. Want to know where we're not heard? Qantas. Want to know what they get to see and hear on Qantas? Yeah. Australia's Qantas Airlines is taking a bold step in the area of in-flight movies. A documentary explaining the female orgasm in graphic detail is now being shown aboard the economy class of international flights. The French-produced film, which features excerpts from old porn films, was included in the airline's in-flight entertainment program because a Qantas spokesperson says it's popular. Passengers' concern that the film is not appropriate for children has been addressed by allowing the crew to block the film on seats occupied by unaccompanied minors upon the request of parents. Or you can just switch the channel to other options like Disney movies, music concerts, snippets from TV shows, and the latest mainstream film releases. So far, there have been no major uproars from the public, although sociologist Michael Flood of the University of Wollongong described the film as not educational. Wow. Leave it to the airline from down under to come up with this idea. Those flights must go through a lot of tissues. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Actor Sean Kanan is best known for his role as Deacon Sharp on The Young and the Restless, but he's also known in Hollywood circles for being a gourmet cook. Sean has a new book out called The Modern Gentleman, Cooking and Entertaining with Sean Kanan, and he joins us on the line from California. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you? Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being on the program. The title of the book, The Modern Gentleman. Why that title?
Why the title? You know, I think that there's, you know, there used to be movies in the 50s, and you would see guys acting like gentlemen, and it just seemed very effortless and easy for them to do it. And I think somewhere along the line, some of that's been lost. Some of the you know, effortless elegance of guys being gentlemen in today's modern world has gotten a little more difficult. And I think some of it has happened as a result of, I think the women's movement has been such a terrific thing for leveling the playing field with women in the workplace, et cetera. But I think it's kind of left guys a little confused. I mean, I think guys sometimes are feeling like, am I supposed to be sort of the sensitive guy that's, you know, at ease with his emotions and openly vulnerable, or am I supposed to be this kind of take charge alpha male guy? And the fact of the matter is, it's really somewhere in between. And I don't think guys really have ever had, they haven't really had, I don't want to say role models, but sort of go-to people the way that women have. I mean, women have always had, you know, Oprah and Martha Stewart and Rachel Ray, et cetera, and guys really haven't had that many people to go to for, you know, issues about, you know, dating and cooking and entertaining and a lot of the stuff that I think women wish that we knew how to do. But unfortunately, a lot of guys don't. And here's the thing. It's not their fault. It's not that, you know, it's not that guys are you know, stupid and just don't know what they're doing in that area. They just have never really had anyone to teach them.
Now, as I said in the introduction, you're also known in Hollywood circles as being a gourmet cook. Is cooking something you did for fun, or did it come out of necessity?
I think it came out of necessity. I really sort of, I'm self-taught, which is one of the great things that I love about this book, because it means that if I can learn to do it, you can learn to do it. When I went away to college, I didn't really have the money to take girls out to fancy dinners, but I just sort of rationalized that if I could learn to cook, that I could provide, you know, them with something that they probably missed, which was a home-cooked meal. And very often, you know, I would have girls that come over for dinner, and they would love to, you know, we had more fun cooking together than going out for a meal. And, you know, as time progressed, I got a little better and a little better, and you know, I lived in Italy for a while, and I picked up a few things there. And, you know, for me, it's kind of therapeutic. I love cooking. I love to turn some music on. I like to, you know, get the steam going, the pots and pans, the chopping, the whole thing.
So what made you decide to come out with this book at this time?
What made me? You know, this is something I've been working on for a while. A lot of my friends had said, you know, you really ought to open up a restaurant. And I think that opening a restaurant is about the quickest way for anybody to lose a lot of money unless you really know what you're doing, which I, you know, not having had a restaurant before, I didn't want to learn on the job. So I decided that I would write a book about cooking. But, you know, the book is really not just about cooking. Cooking is one part of it. And, yes, there's I think, 75 or 80 recipes in the book. But the book really is written, it's directed towards guys, but it's also written so that women can kind of get a front row seat and sort of pull back the curtain on the male psyche, kind of learn how guys think. And it's a great book for women to get for the guys in their lives to help them become better guys. And it's a great book for women to read to sort of get a, you know, like I said, a front row seat to how I think guys think, at least how this guy thinks.
Okay, so now that you've done the book, as you say, people thought you should open a restaurant. Is that idea still in the back somewhere? Do you think now maybe a restaurant comes out of all this?
You know, look, I mean, you know, my life has gone in so many directions that I never thought that it would go, that I've learned not to rule anything out. I just think that a restaurant would be such a full-time endeavor, not right now. But you know what? I mean, I do love cooking. I love being around it. Maybe. Not in the near future, but maybe, you know, I really want to get out there. I want to promote the book. I've got some more film projects coming up later in the year. And so right now I think I'm really just focused on that. But you know what? Never say never.
What kind of cuisine does the book feature?
You know, it doesn't really feature one specific kind. I think that it gives you a good cross-section of a lot of different things. I teach how to make some basic sauces, some meals that you can make on a budget. I also have some theme nights. One of the ones I do is like sort of a Middle Eastern theme night, where I teach you how to make couscous with roasted vegetables and lamb chops with mint, and more than that, really how to set the mood at your house if you're entertaining. You know, everything from creating sort of a playlist on your iPod with sort of vibey, sexy Moroccan music to you know, to setting the aesthetic of the place so that really it's almost like you're sort of being transported to a different, you know, a different place, which I think that's part of when you're entertaining. It's always fun to try and create the illusion of being somewhere else to, you know, to have people kind of be able to their sort of daily work and sort of go to another world. And, you know, you can do that sometimes, you know, with candles and with lighting. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that I talk about is stuff that I've learned from, you know, TV and film sets. You know, some of the stuff that you can do with lighting, even inexpensively, to kind of create that ambiance.
What is your favorite meal that you like to make?
Oh, that I like to make?
Yeah.
I try and eat pretty healthy. So for me, I try and do low carb meals. I'm a big fan of most Asian foods, so I try and use a lot of Asian influence on most of the things I do. So I like to use things like chili paste and soy sauce, and you know, I'll combine that with either salmon or chicken, and usually do something simple like bok choy with pineapple, maybe saute it with a little bit of garlic and sesame oil. And, you know, for me, generally, that's kind of how I eat. I'm a sucker for a really well-cooked steak. I love a good piece of meat that's marinated and done on the grill. And, you know, that's part of what the book teaches, is that you don't really have to have super advanced cooking technique. You don't have to have, you know, a kitchen that is tricked out with the newest and latest, most expensive appliances and gadgets to make really great meals. In the book, what I do is I use the analogy of the theater. And the first chapter is called, I think it's called The Modern Gentleman Prepares the Theater. And the theater is the kitchen. And I talk about how, you know, great drama can come from a stage as simple as a stage in a high school, or it can come from Carnegie Hall. It doesn't matter. It has to do with the talent that's on the stage. And so I help you equip your kitchen based upon your budget. And then we equip the pantry and all the staples that you need to have, and then I move into the different menu choices and the different theme nights. So I think by the time you're done reading the book, you're gonna have a really good idea of how not only to entertain, but to cook some pretty terrific meals for not a lot of money that are gonna really be a lot of fun for everybody.
In doing publicity for this book, I'm sure you get an opportunity to come across fans of yours as Deacon Sharp on The Young and the Restless. Are people surprised that, you know, the bad boy of The Young and the Restless is a great cook in the kitchen?
I think a lot of people have probably a little bit of a preconceived idea of who I am based upon that character. And Deacon is certainly a guy that's pretty rough around the edges. Although, Deacon did manage a bar and is now working as a bartender in a restaurant. So he's had a little bit of restaurant experience. But, I think people are a little bit surprised when they find out that I'm not really the same guy as I play on TV.
Is there the opportunity in your role as Deacon working in a bar and a restaurant to sneak in some of Sean Kanan's recipes?
I don't know. I mean, right now my character is on parole working as a bartender and lucky to have that job. So I don't know if I'm going to have an opportunity anytime soon to sneak in any of my recipes. But you know what's fun is some of the recipes actually came from people I know. Either they had taught me the recipe or it was something central in their lives. And Christian LeBlanc, who plays Michael Baldwin on The Young and the Restless, his mother apparently had won an award for a recipe that she had, which is for an oyster stew. And so we were talking about it. I said, would you mind if I actually put that in the book, sort of as a tribute to him being my friend and to his mother's recipe, which won an award in Louisiana. So a lot of the recipes have come from, you know, either my travels or some of the experiences that I've had either abroad or living in Hollywood. And what I do is I give sort of an anecdote or a story about how I came up with each of these recipes or how they came to me.
The thing that sounds great in talking to you about this book is that clearly you have a great passion for cooking and for talking about the book. You can hear it in your voice. It sounds like you're really excited about this project.
I am excited about it. I mean, it's my first literary effort. That just finishing a book is kind of a Herculean task. I mean, it really, you know, it's especially in the midst of a lot of the other stuff that I'm doing. So I'm just very proud that that it's been finished. My girlfriend, Michelle, took all of the photos of the food. So it was really great that we got to kind of collaborate on the book and work together as a team. And I think there's going to be a lot of provocative stuff that's going to come from this stuff about talking about, you know, dating and what it's like to kind of conduct yourself as a gentleman in this modern world. You know, a lot of times I hear guys talk about things like, you know, I really like this girl, but I keep getting this speech about, you know, she just sees me as a nice guy and wants to be my friend. And I have a chapter in the book called The Modern Gentleman is a Nice Guy, but Not a Nice Guy, in quotes. And or in quotation. I always get that confused. The quotes are in quotation marks.
In quotes.
which is it.
Yeah. In quotes.
In quotes. I was
yeah.
right. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think I talk very honestly and openly about maybe some of the mistakes that I've made, some of what I've learned, and some of the ways that I think, you know, it's, you know, the guys would benefit from relating to women. And I think this is a really terrific book, especially for, you know, young guys that are maybe going off to college for the first time, leaving the house for the first time, going to be living on their own or with a roommate. And that's really, like I said, that's where I started to learn to cook and started to develop some of my ideas about entertaining and dating, and lots of them were wrong. And you learn along the way to through sort of a baptism by fire to refine them. And, you know, now at the age of 44, hopefully I've learned a couple things, and I'd like to share it with everybody out there. And as I said before, it's a book that's for men and women alike.
The book is called The Modern Gentleman, Cooking and Entertaining with Sean Kanan. Sean, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
Actor Sean Kanan and his book, The Modern Gentleman, Cooking and Entertaining with Sean Kanan. Sean has several book signings coming up. One is on Friday, August the 26th. He'll be at the Young and the Restless Fan Club Dinner. That's at the Sheraton Universal in Los Angeles. On Thursday, September 15th, he'll be at the Drama Bookshop in New York from 6 to 8 p.m. The following Thursday, September 22nd, he'll be back in L.A. at Barnes & Noble on Ventura Boulevard from 6 to 8 p.m. And there are more signings that are on his schedule. You can find a list of those signings and links on my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0105, and you'll find links to Sean's site with all those signings listed right there on his site, plus links to Amazon.com where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Do you know what the first thing is to be touched by sunlight each morning in our nation's capital? If you said it's the top of the Washington Monument, you're right. Now, what two words are inscribed on the tip of the monument? They're the Latin words, Laus Deo, which mean, praise be to God. I thought of this recently when reading about a controversy involving prayer in a Texas courtroom. Each day, the court in Bowie County begins with a ceremonial prayer. However, the judge in that Texas court doesn't want the official records to mention that a prayer is said. Why? He's afraid the court will be sued. Let's be fair. A ceremonial prayer is still said at the start of every session of Congress. That has never changed. What has changed, though, is that the fear of being sued has become such a constant part of American life, and lawsuits cost taxpayers and local governments millions of dollars to defend. Too often, they say it's just not worth fighting. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet a former undercover federal agent. Plus, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, one more Stuff File news story for you. Inmate Jonathan Pinney, age 26, petitioned U.S. District Court in Chicago in July, demanding that the state and federal officials stop arresting him because he did nothing illegal, he wrote, despite his current 4-year sentence for aggravated battery on a police officer. Pinney helpfully suggested a way for the federal government to compensate him for all the grief it has caused him. The government should give him $50 billion restitution, that's $50 billion with a B, and award him uninhabited land so that he can start his own country with sovereign and diplomatic immunity. Pinney appeared to solicit romance on his MySpace page, and how does someone in jail have a MySpace page is what I want to know. Anyway, by writing that he hopes to get into a committed relationship with a woman, but wouldn't mind if it meant leaving this world and marrying an alien with similar anatomy and genetics. Wow. I don't think he needs a committed relationship. I think he just needs to be committed. Anyway, Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Robert Major is a former undercover federal agent. He spent half a decade risking his life undercover. He's the author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. He joins us on the line from Florida. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thank you very much for the invitation.
Thanks for being on the program with us. A dangerous life indeed. First of all, what kind of person is the kind of person who goes undercover? I would suspect it's a special breed of personality.
It's a volunteer position, and in most agencies, in the federal agencies that I was in, it involves somewhat of a vetting process where you go through an undercover school, where that school is generally run by some of the best undercover agents that have worked previously. One of my mentors, who was part of the training, is Joe Pistone, who the book and the movie Donnie Brasco is based on. And there are also psychologists who participate in the vetting process, looking for characteristics in individuals that they feel are going to be able to help them better deal with the stress, the physical and mental stress that they're going to be encountering by living a double life for years at an end. And ultimately, by the candidate for either long-term or medium-term or short-term based upon what they believe their abilities are to be able to handle that type of an assignment. And after that, I wound up being given about a year and a half's time to put together a sophisticated identity in front. I did that with the help of about a half dozen informants and concerned citizens, and emerged from that as an active member in a series of businesses. It was an investment company in Florida, a mortgage company in Florida, an air charter service that operated from Florida to the Bahamas, a jewelry store with a chain of 70 outlets in the United States, and then also a brokerage firm with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. So that plus the endorsement of two informants within one of the New York Italian-American crime families, I really didn't have to be the best undercover agent in the world in order to accomplish what I did. I was, I think, well prepared. I was given the best training I could possibly get, and given an opportunity to really put things together so that I'd be able to survive within the underworld.
As an undercover agent, how far are you allowed to go when it comes to actually committing a crime?
Well, in the U.S., there, in order to operate in one of these long-term undercover operations, there is what's called an attorney general's exemption that's issued for the undercover operation, specifically identifying those crimes that that you're allowed to commit. And in my instance, it was strictly the laundering of drug proceeds. That's the only crime that I was allowed to commit. So, and it's extraordinarily important for officers that are in this type of an environment to remember that they are there as the eyes and ears of the public and cannot, regardless of how much the targets may try to entice them to get involved in other types of criminal offenses, they're not at liberty to do that. And that's part of the thing of learning how to stay grounded and how to deflect those types of overtures. Sometimes people find it hard to imagine that, you know, you're working within a Colombian drug cartel and you might not be exposed to, say, the use of drugs. But these organizations run just like Fortune 500 companies. The people I dealt with were highly educated attorneys, doctors, businessmen. They spoke three languages or more. They also would not give you the responsibility that I had, which was to handle literally tens of millions of dollars for them, and not only just pass the money on, but also invested it in accounts in banks, in active businesses, in the building of apartment complexes. They would not be giving me that kind of responsibility if I was the type of individual who would engage in risky behavior. As a matter of fact, I was in meetings where My highest ranking direct report within the Medellin cartel was a guy by the name of Santiago Uribe, who was the consigliere, one of the main advisors to Pablo Escobar. He was a professor at the University of Medellin, a practicing lawyer, and he was an advisor to the legislature in Colombia. That's what everybody thought he was. In reality, he was an advisor as to global money laundering plans for the cartel. He was also one of the people who passed judgment on who might be appropriately eliminated, murdered, because they posed a risk. And we had an individual at a meeting, in a series of meetings, who was definitely an individual who was engaging in risky behavior. He was not only using drugs, he was a heavy drinker, he's loud, he spoke out of turn. I was there when an order was given that he should be eliminated. So these are not nice people, but they certainly do run their business like their drug organizations like businesses, and you need to make sure that you've got yourself well grounded and you're not getting involved in any type of risky behavior, because that's not what they're expecting from people at the higher end of the organizations.
Okay, so besides the fact that you forget the idea of temptations of any kind, be it the money, the drugs, whatever the case may be, you're undercover for a period of time and you get to know these people. And I'm sure there are certainly different degrees of criminality. Does it become difficult when you work, befriend these people, that you know at some point you're going to turn them in?
Well, you know, there certainly is an awareness of that. I think that, you know, if you didn't have a sense of feeling about that, you probably wouldn't be normal. That's a very normal reaction to a very abnormal environment that you're in. I had to act as though these were people who I really cared about, who truly were my friend. The one person who probably I got the closest to, the guy who mentored me and really vouched for me within the cartel, is a person who was living in the United States, although he was half Chilean, half Sicilian, and he ran a number of businesses, fronts, high-end jewelry store, fight promoter, investor in real estate. I got to know him, his family, his children, his wife. And I also came to realize that things that he told me, although he was a bad guy and was doing bad things, he was truthful with me. He was honest with me. And his family, certainly I knew, would be enduring a lot of pain. His children knew nothing about what he was really doing. And so that does wear on your mind some. I address in my book, you know, you unfortunately give up a little bit of your soul when you work in this environment. But you also have to remember why you're there, why the public entrusted their faith in you to be there, and you just got to do your job and living with the emotional consequences of that is something that you need to recognize as you go into it.
Is it possible at all, speaking, you mentioned the word family, is it possible in this type of job to even have a family?
Oh yeah. Well, you mean as far as the undercover agents are concerned?
Yes.
Yeah, I had, my wife and I had been married for quite some time. I had, you know, two children, 9 and 11, at the time that the operation started. And it is something that definitely needs to be taken into consideration before you get into the operation. One of the things that I think helped substantially for us was the fact that I had not been moved from city to city, and then put into an undercover capacity where my family was in an environment where they didn't have any support. I had a lot of family members in the same city, who could help and provide support. And you also need to have a spouse that has their own profession and isn't in a situation where they need, where all they're doing, and I say all, because it's a tremendous responsibility to raise children, but if they also have a profession that they need to be addressing, it certainly helps, because they have a lot of things that are going on that they need to do, and they assimilate, they make adjustments. My wife basically became the dad and mom.
So what happens when the kids say, what does daddy do for a living? What was the cover that daddy did for a living?
Now, my kids knew that I was a federal agent, and my kids knew that I was working in the drug money laundering field. They didn't know the details of what was going on, but they were, they lived with that all of their lives. I mean, I was an agent before they were born, and they knew not to talk about that, with their friends. That's not a topic of volunteer. But to just say that your father is a federal agent and works for a federal agency is, about as far as they would generally get in a conversation with their friends. And they wouldn't know what was really going on in the case. They'd know I need to be out of town for a considerable period of time, but they wouldn't know the details of what was really going on.
And we have less than a minute, so I have to ask this question. The book is called The Infiltrator. Is there any concern when you decide to write a book like this of somebody coming after you after the fact?
Well, that's always a possibility for every law enforcement officer. I know law enforcement officers that have been killed at the hands of criminals and never worked undercover just because they retaliated against them. I think that telling this story is too important for me to become obsessed with that type of a concern. There's probably a very small handful of people beside myself who've had the opportunity to see the inside of the drug world the way that I did, and the money laundering world. I mean, I dealt at the same time I was dealing with the leaders of the cartels, I was dealing also with the senior management of what was the seventh largest privately held bank in the world, who were actively involved laundering money all over the globe. So giving the public insight to that and how that occurs and what that involves as far as an active and knowing involvement of the international banking community soliciting deposits from drug organizations that produce around the globe $400 billion a year is something that happens, unfortunately, every day.
The book is called The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. It's written by Robert Mazur. And Robert, I thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Robert Mazur, former undercover federal agent and author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. You can find his website at the-infiltrator.com. And you can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0105. And you'll find links to his site, plus also links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
In Roseville, California, police arrested a 24-year-old man for doing an impression of Fred Flintstone while driving. Unfortunately, he hit four cars in the process. Witnesses say they saw the man stop to check his brakes, which had apparently failed. He then decided to keep driving anyway while hanging his feet outside the vehicle door to serve as brakes. When he couldn't stop in time to avoid running a red light, he hit two cars in an intersection. He then still drove off, still using his feet as brakes, and hit two more cars at the next intersection. Then he finally stopped. Mr. Flintstone, and I'm doing air quotes here, was also driving with a suspended license, but was completely sober. Deputy Chief James Berlin said he'll face a judge in September to explain his moronic decision-making. While there was plenty of vehicle damage, fortunately nobody was hurt. Now, I've seen the video of this clown. There was a dashboard cam on the cops that finally stopped him. This wasn't a tiny smart car. This guy was driving a pickup truck with a full payload. So why did he think he could stop anything larger than a baby stroller with his feet? One reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0105. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0105. You could email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here on the air, online, or as a download for our next show. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for 0105. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.